Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we tell you about a Microsoft pilot project to expand local news in four cities, including one here in the Valley. And arts critic Donald Monroe gives us the latest on the controversial Tower Theater sale. But first, despite the widespread economic devastation of the pandemic, the tragedy has created an unlikely opportunity for new investments into housing options for those experiencing homelessness in the Fresno area. That's thanks to millions in state and federal aid. FM89's Sarith Hawk takes us to some of the locations.
The lobby of Fresno's Crossroads Village housing complex is busy this Friday afternoon.
Crossroads Village, this is Grace. How can I help you?
The facility used to be Smuggler's Inn, then Hotel Fresno on North Blackstone near Dakota. But just this year, it reopened, newly renovated as a permanent housing option for formerly homeless and low-income tenants. One of those tenants is Catherine Miranda. She stands outside the complex overlooking Blackstone Avenue. She just moved into Crossroads Village about a month ago. Before that, she was on the streets for 9 years. Her first night in her new room was so quiet, she says.
The first night I couldn't sleep because we were so used to the train. But I mean, it's wonderful.
Miranda found out about housing programs through the Pavarello House and applied. She chose Crossroads Village, where tenants are required to pay a monthly subsidized rent and sign a 12-month lease.
Why should I go somewhere where I don't have to pay rent? That's going to make me, that's just like being on the streets if you have somewhere over your head. You know what I mean?
Miranda believes taking on the financial responsibility is key to getting back on her feet. And she's able to stay here because with the pandemic came millions of dollars of extra funding for homeless housing and strict deadlines for development. Fresno County used its $15 million grant from California's HomeKey project to purchase and renovate the hotel into 165 permanent housing units.
Crossroads Village has been a unique opportunity to bring a large amount of units on very, very quickly.
That's Katie Wilbur. She's the executive director of RH Community Builders, the private developer that's renovated the facility and operates the program in partnership with Fresno County.
Yeah, so this is our main building.
Today, she gives a tour of the property.
We do have two community spaces in here.
She takes out her keys to open the door to a studio. It looks like a typical hotel room with two queen-sized beds.
They come with a microwave and a hot plate and a refrigerator, and it's their home.
Wilbur says the ability to renovate an existing space was the fastest solution to offer housing to a growing population of people experiencing homelessness. Newly released figures from the U.S. Census Bureau shows the rental vacancy rate in Fresno dropped from 6.9% in 2019 to less than 1% in 2020, as available housing disappeared during the pandemic. To combat this lack of housing, the city is working with the Fresno Housing Authority on an even larger scale motel project. Councilmember Miguel Arias starts up his car and heads over to Parkway Drive in central Fresno, where a strip of motels stretches down the street right across from Highway 99.
Has acquired six motels in this drive and has renovated five of them, and they're fully occupied now.
Like Crossroads Village, the purchases and renovations for these motels were put on the fast track due to $34 million from the HomeKey project. The city allocated another $8 million in CARES Act money to fund motel operations for the next 5 years. The project is in a blighted area, says Arias.
So this is what is known as the red light district of the Central Valley.
Arias says he saw an opportunity to clean up the area by targeting motels engaging in illegal activities.
The level of human trafficking and drug trafficking was so blatant that they would do it in the open.
He says turning some of the most run-down motels into temporary housing for homeless individuals was a win-win. He points to a motel that's now been converted to temporary housing for those transitioning from drug treatment programs.
This was Parkside Inn, one of the worst facilities of human trafficking.
He says there are safety measures to protect residents. The perimeter is covered with a chain-link fence.
As you can see, the facility is gated off.
Each renovated motel has 24-hour security, and most are gated to keep non-residents out. But because of the area, the project does have its critics.
We're dealing with people with drug addiction, people with mental health, people that are just down on their luck, and we're putting them all together in one of the highest crime areas in Fresno.
That's homeless advocate Des Martinez. She's making dinner this afternoon at one of the encampments she manages at the corner of Broadway and San Benito under the Highway 99 overpass.
Hold on 1 second. I think my beans are burning.
Martinez runs to check on the big pot of beans she's cooking to make sure they aren't burning.
Oh, no, they're not.
She lived on the streets for a year and a half and now runs her nonprofit, We Are Not Invisible, providing support services for the unhoused. She thinks the Highway 99 project is too dangerous. She says her friends who have been placed in the motels don't feel safe.
It wasn't cleaned up. We just scooped up a whole bunch of people and just threw them in a pit of wolves.
Martinez was especially concerned about the location of the women and children shelter.
We have a family motel on the same block with drugs, sex trafficking, all that stuff. We could have had the family motel, the family shelter, way away from there. Not on Parkway.
These motels are what city officials call transitional housing that will ultimately be renovated into permanent housing. For now, because of the lack of housing in Fresno, there's no limit on the amount of time people can stay for free at these motels. But Martinez isn't critical of all the housing projects. She says she really likes Crossroads Village.
So it's great because the property is beautiful. The building, it looks beautiful. You are a product of your environment.
Back on Blackstone Avenue, Catherine Miranda agrees. She plans on staying at Crossroads Village for a long time, and now she's looking for work. Her Crossroads Village caseworker recently helped her apply for a job at the Poverello House.
Yeah. Until I feel that I'm fit enough or ready enough to go out there into the world, to have my own place, I'll be here.
And she won't be alone. The complex is approaching 80% capacity and should be filled up by the end of March. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Microsoft is piloting a new project to increase and support local news in four cities across the country, including Fresno. KVPR was among the newsrooms chosen for the collaboration, along with the Fresno Bee, Vida en Ovalle, and Radio Bilingue. To learn more, I spoke with one of our reporters, Mati Bolaños, and our news director, Alice Daniel. Also joining the conversation, Project Director Rebecca Plevin and Radio Bilingue Director of National News and Information, Samuel Orozco. So Alice, I know that you, like me, are a big believer in the importance of local journalism. Tell us why it's so important to you and how is this new project going to support local journalism here in the Central Valley?
Sure. So what Microsoft is doing in this pilot program is it's utilizing its tech expertise, resources, and funding to initially help four cities in the U.S. preserve and expand local news. And, you know, why such an emphasis on local news? Well, many of us know, and maybe not enough of us know, that a healthy democracy relies on well-reported local news. And local news in the U.S. right now is kind of hemorrhaging. It's a huge concern in terms of disinformation and the kinds of places people are looking for news now. They need fact-based, good local news in their communities. And in the past 15 years or so, 2,100 newspapers have closed, and the pandemic has put even more stress on newsrooms. There's been massive job cuts. So it's something that we really need to be paying attention to. And we're fortunate that Microsoft chose Fresno and three other cities and their surrounding region. So they chose Fresno, El Paso, Texas, Jackson, Mississippi, and Yakima, Washington, in part because of third-party recommendations talking about the kinds of news we're already covering. We're already looking into communities and working hard to, you know, hear the voices of people that don't typically get heard. But the fact also that these places are diverse, they appreciate local news, they're already doing this interesting community reporting, but we need more local news. And so the pilot programs are kind of a collaboration of local media, including ethnic media, and it gives us all a chance to work together and expand our reach in both print and radio, and also rely on each other for sources, resources, and story ideas. For example, you know, we all have our different areas that we cover. In our newsroom, we have three reporters, so we don't get to cover everything. We do some things really well, but we can't cover everything. And so with this collaboration, we'll be able to do more and reach a wider audience, hopefully. Hopefully, you know, this has the potential to elevate local journalism and keep the Valley better informed on key issues. And in terms of like what we will cover, we know that we want to cover COVID-19 and we want to cover underserved communities and essential workers, because we know that over the next year, there's going to be a major fallout from COVID and people are going to continue to suffer because of it. And it's important that we cover that news. And Rebecca Plevin and I, Rebecca is the project director, and she and I have been talking about this a little bit more, but I'll go ahead and hand it over to you and Rebecca, because I think she could speak to this more in terms of, you know, what kinds of stories we want to cover.
Yeah, absolutely. Rebecca, tell us your vision for this project and how it perhaps has been informed by the kind of reporting that you've done in the past.
Sure. Thanks, Kathleen. So, you know, through this collaboration, I'm hoping that we are able to investigate how communities of color in the Central Valley have been disproportionately impacted, you know, physically and financially by COVID-19. I am coming to this project from the Desert Sun in Palm Springs. I was a reporter there for 3 years covering immigration, and I covered both immigration at the border. I also covered how farm workers were impacted by COVID-19 and their access to the coronavirus vaccine. And then previously, I actually spent about 5 years working in the Central Valley, both for Vida en el Valle, which is a bilingual paper, which is part of this collaboration, and for Valley Public Radio. I was a reporter many years ago. So I'm just really excited to be back in the Central Valley and focusing on these really important issues. You know, I'm hoping that we are able to introduce our audience to essential workers who have labored throughout the pandemic, you know, have gotten sick while working through the pandemic. I hope that we can introduce our audience to families that have lost incomes over the past year and have struggled to make ends meet. You know, the Central Valley is such an interesting place to report because it is a vast area. So we are hoping that our reporting will, you know, go into the Central Valley's agricultural fields and the rural communities that are far from the city centers. And we'll do this with the goal of, you know, fostering a deeper understanding of the realities that many in our communities face. You know, I hope that we'll also identify the barriers to, you know, healing and recovery to, you know, as we explore whether there is this fallout, as Alice mentioned, we'll identify these barriers to healing and recovery, as well as the people and policies that are striving to, you know, bridge those gaps and bring around recovery after this unprecedented year that we've all been through. And so I'm just really excited about the opportunity for, you know, reporters at the B and Valley Public Radio and Vida en el Valle to work together to tell these stories. And I'm really excited about the opportunity to share these stories over the airwaves of Valley Public Radio and Radio Bilingue. I think we have a really great opportunity to strengthen local news and tell really deep stories about this region.
Yeah, and really elevate all of the work that these different organizations are doing independently, you know, by working together and working collaboratively. It's going to be really interesting to see what comes out of this. You know, our own Madi Bolaños has been doing phenomenal reporting on immigrant communities here in the Central Valley. Madi, I would love for you to talk a bit about how the work that you have been doing is going to connect with this collaboration and your role within this project.
Yeah, I cover immigration and underserved communities, and I have been for the last year. And so that means going into small towns like Fireball and Mendota and speaking to these people and how they're affected by the pandemic. And it's different everywhere you go. In Fireball, there are family-owned businesses that are struggling to make ends meet. And in other places, there are farm workers who are struggling to find access to the vaccine or to make appointments or to get information in their language. So speaking with them has been very helpful and will continue to be helpful in contributing to this project that I'm so excited is finally rolling out. So I've already been doing some of this reporting. When I was in Fireball, I focused on restaurants and how they're faring throughout the pandemic. And I actually spoke to one business owner who is the restaurant owner at Don Pepe. And he talked about the struggles to get financial aid during this time. He applauds the work of getting PPE from the county, but he really emphasized that he doesn't have any money and he doesn't know how he's going to continue to support this business that supports his family.
They give us masks and hand sanitizers, yes, but that doesn't help much. They can have a big round of applause for that, for sure. But what we need now is money.
And then earlier in the pandemic, UC Merced came out with a study that showed undocumented women were being the most affected in terms of job loss. And I had the opportunity to speak to Maria, who is in Merced, and she is undocumented and chose not to share her full name for that reason. But she talked to me about being a housekeeper and making pretty good money. Before the pandemic, she helped clean about 4 houses a week. And like I said, it was good money for her, but she's also older and so are her clients. So once the pandemic hit, she was afraid to go to work and they were afraid to have her at work. They were trying to mitigate their risk, but of course that weighed heavily on her finances. And here she is as well.
It hit all of us. And we all came out of it around the same time, except for my wife. She is still not doing well.
Not working has affected me a lot because I have no money and I don't receive any government aid.
You know, so many people in our community get their news from non-English media outlets or ethnic media outlets like Radio Bilingue, which is a part of this collaboration. Samuel, tell us about the role that you will play individually and your organization is going to play in this project.
Well, let me tell you first that we are very excited to join this collaboration with the Fresno Bee and with KBPR. And the idea is basically to amplify the voice of those most impacted by the pandemic in the Valley, who in a Valley that has been at times a hotspot of statewide and national proportions. And some of the most impacted people tend to be Spanish-speaking people, Latinos, farm workers, migrants, who are hard to reach with needed information. So what we are looking forward to in this collaboration is, A, we are expecting to give the collaborative access to stories generated by our interactive call-in programs, by our reporting that could be of a benefit to other media. Sometimes we hear from farm workers who report, for example, co-workers who come to work while having tested positive for COVID, or workers who are unable to isolate themselves after being exposed to someone infected with COVID, or people who report the fears about using public benefits or public help, like housing for isolation, due to immigration concerns, or we hear from listeners about misperceptions about the vaccine. The fear that the vaccine is going to come with a microchip that is going to track the undocumented or the secondary effects or complications due to the vaccine, or the fact that the vaccine is so new. So those are the kind of things that we listen to from farm workers or essential workers in general who call in to our interactive programs. So we expect to provide a kind of access to those stories, to that information, to that collaborative. At the same time, we would greatly benefit from accessing the local data that's been generated by the collaborative, data on COVID cases, on testing, on vaccines, on housing, on other public services that reporters at the collaborative will be generating through these months. And all the stories from the field reporting and other stories that the team is going to be able to create, both on KBPR and the Fresno Bee. So we could greatly benefit from that. I think I agree with the comments made previously by my colleagues about how all this information is going to benefit local journalism, local reporting in general. I think it's going to inject a tremendous degree of dose of energy into local journalism. And this is going to, I think, impact the overall health of the community, since all this information is going to help local citizens to make decisions, you know, sometimes critical decisions, life or death decisions in terms of how to protect themselves from the pandemic, or how to access testing, how to access vaccines, how to access emergency aid, where, all the way to informing the decisions in terms of voting for local offices or voting for state offices, etc. Local journalism in that sense is going to play, continues to be playing a significant role. So the fact that we are joining forces is going to help to amplify, to magnify the voice of so many of the local citizens, especially those that are hardly heard in the national media or the statewide media.
Rebecca, I'd like to come back to you. This conversation has made me think about the way the media gets the immigration story wrong. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a bit about some of the challenges associated with covering immigration stories and some of the misperceptions that have been perpetuated as a result of maybe those challenges.
Yeah, that's a great question, Kathleen. I think from my experience, I mean, immigration is a challenging topic to cover because it is a, you know, it has become a really polarizing issue in our country. I mean, you see in Washington, D.C., they're again discussing immigration reform. This is something that has, you know, that Congress has dealt with or has tried to deal with for years and years because it is a really polarizing issue. But when it comes down to it, I mean, you have millions of people in this country who came here. And a lot of people now are, you know, especially after the past 4 years, you have a lot of immigrants who are, you know, especially undocumented immigrants who are really scared right now, who have, you know, had to live in the shadows for a long time. And, you know, reporting, one of the challenges of reporting is that, you know, people have been afraid, and it is, you know, challenging to sometimes connect with people and share those stories, even though I think sharing those stories is a way. I'm a real believer that sharing stories is a real important way to bridge understanding between communities. You know, and I think this story becomes especially interesting here in the Central Valley, where, you know, agriculture is the main driving force of this region, you know, and a lot of, you know, agriculture in many ways is powered by farm workers, many of whom are Latino, many of whom are immigrants, some of whom are undocumented immigrants. And so this story becomes really, really important, and understanding becomes really important because, you know, farm workers are such, and the people who work in the agricultural industry are such critical parts of the Central Valley community. You know, there are all sorts of myths out there about immigration, and I'm hopeful that, you know, through our reporting, we will, you know, just be able to bring, you know, continue to elevate voices and provide real facts and truth that hopefully will, like, bridge some of that polarization.
I could only add to this the fact that, yes, I think it is especially important in these days, in the days when immigration and immigrant communities in particular have been the target of so much misinformation and been the center of these cultural wars, it is so important to make the voice of immigrants, especially those working on essential jobs, being part of the public dialogue and make them visible players at a time, again, when they are becoming basically the ones who are providing the worst, they're becoming the ones who are falling victims of COVID in the largest numbers of infected and hospitalizations and dead people. So at this time, I think it is much more important to have them on the public table, let's say, on the public sphere, being part of the dialogue, being part of the conversation, and we would be more than happy to be part of that collaboration, of that effort to make immigrants and essential workers part of this public conversation with the rest of the public.
Well, before we wrap up, Alice, I'd like to give you the last word. What are some of the other benefits that are associated with being a part of this collaboration with Microsoft?
Apart from the funding, which has allowed the Fresno Bee to hire Rebecca as a project manager, Microsoft has also been offering, online training, including some basic audio training that I think has been good for print media, also giving us information about, how to track disinformation, how to use data journalism to support what we're working on. And I think, one of the best benefits is the fact that there are three other cities with media doing the same thing. And I think that we have the benefit of also being in touch with them and seeing what they're doing, how they're combating misinformation or tracking it, or what are they doing to make sure communities get good local news. Because what we all want out of this is an appreciation and an expansion of local news, because we know that that is, one of the pillars of a healthy democracy.
I've been talking with Rebecca Plevin, project editor for the Central Valley Collaborative Lab, along with Samuel Orozco with Radio Bilingue and Valley Public Radio's own news director, Alice Daniel, and reporter Madi Bolaños. Thank you all for being on the show, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what this collaboration brings to light in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Through the summer surge, then the winter surge, and now the vaccine rollout, COVID-19 has been the dominant public health story for a year now. But other health problems haven't just disappeared. This includes Valley fever, which, despite being a fungal disease, actually runs parallel to COVID in many ways. Here with more is FM89's Carrie Klein as part of our weekly COVID update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So as usual, let's begin with a look across the valley this week.
Well, Kathleen, just as we've been seeing for the past few weeks, the important COVID-19 measures keep improving. So case rates are down, hospital and ICU occupancies keep dropping, and we're finally seeing a slowdown in deaths due to COVID-19. And barring any more death certificate backlogs that result in kind of a jump in the data, there have been 40% fewer reports of COVID-related deaths this week than just last week. Regionally, we've administered 586,000 vaccine doses. And although all counties in our area are still administering vaccines at a slower rate than the state average, we are catching up to the state average. And that reflects the bump in vaccine allocation that we began receiving in the last few weeks. When it comes to the state's reopening blueprint, Mariposa County advanced to the orange tier this week, allowing many businesses to expand their indoor operations, but all other counties in our region are still in the purple, most restrictive tier. And in reopening news, just yesterday, the Newsom administration announced new rules for breweries, wineries, and distilleries. Even those that don't serve food can open outdoors only in the purple and red tiers. However, bars with no food remain closed in both of those tiers.
And then what's the latest in vaccine news?
Well, one piece of news is that our region has begun receiving the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. This is the third one approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. There has not been a huge allocation to the Valley yet, but that's anticipated to ramp up as time goes on. What's interesting is that because this vaccine is logistically much easier to handle than the others, it actually can give health officials some more flexibility in how they administer it. For instance, in Fresno County, health officials are planning to use that vaccine for mobile clinics and hard-to-reach rural areas because that vaccine, which is one dose only, eliminates the need for a second clinic. The other big news is that starting Monday, the state is opening up vaccine eligibility to younger adults with chronic conditions or who are otherwise medically vulnerable. So that's anyone aged 16 to 64 with cancer, kidney or pulmonary disease, obesity, diabetes, and many other conditions that weaken the immune system. So that's a huge next step in the vaccine rollout.
It most certainly is. Well, now let's turn to Valley fever. It's a disease that people can develop after they inhale the spores of a fungus that get kicked up from the soil. The fungus grows throughout the Southwest and up the West Coast, but ground zero is here in the San Joaquin Valley and in parts of Arizona. Carrie, we've been covering this fungal disease for years at FM89. What's new now?
So what's new is the pandemic, which is in some ways complicating the public health response to Valley fever, which was already chronically under-resourced. The WNYC show Science Friday recently ran a segment on the battle against both Valley fever and the pandemic here in the West, and I spoke about it with the show's science reporter and digital producer, Lauren Young. Here's a segment of our interview beginning with what got her interested in this disease in the first place.
I'm originally from the Central Valley. I grew up actually not too far from the KVPR studio in Clovis, so pretty familiar with the area. And the San Joaquin Valley is one of the major hotspots for Valley fever. My mom caught it when she was a teenager working on a family onion farm. And that was the first time that I had heard about it. She had told me the story later on. And she got pretty sick with, you know, lesions, shortness of breath, and other symptoms that result from Valley fever. She recovered, but that story just stuck with me ever since. And I've talked to clinicians and patients today and learned so much more about how Valley fever is a larger public health issue. Thousands of people get sick with this disease. The severity of it can really vary from, you know, minor cold-like symptoms to lifelong chronic illness. We see, unfortunately, a lot more cases of severe Valley fever among Black people and Filipinos. So it's really considered a health disparity in many communities. And I think right now with COVID-19 and the pandemic, it's added a whole new layer of challenges with diagnosing and treating and living with a pre-existing condition. And so I think that, you know, speaking to these public health issues is a very important topic, I think, for, you know, places like Science Friday, which, you know, cover national topics.
Well, I'm glad that your mother's case of Valley fever turned out to be all right.
Yeah, yeah. She's completely recovered. She was able to get treated when she was younger. So, yeah.
That's great. Well, and so most people who get Valley fever emerge with either no symptoms or very mild ones. But of course, you know, like with COVID-19, Valley fever can be very severe. It can spread throughout the entire body. Does this leave Valley fever patients more vulnerable to COVID-19? And is co-infection of these two diseases particularly common?
Yeah, so not that experts know of in terms of being more at risk of being more susceptible to COVID-19. So right now, doctors at Kern Medical's Valley Fever Institute in Bakersfield, they say that Valley fever patients are just as susceptible to getting COVID-19 as other people in their age group and with similar health conditions. And in reverse, getting COVID-19 doesn't mean that you are more susceptible to getting Valley fever. But if a patient has, you know, the disseminated severe version of Valley fever, which you had mentioned, and they do contract COVID, they could be at a greater risk for complications with COVID-19. So, you know, there are some patients with Valley fever who've lost portions of their lungs or lung cavities because of the disease. Those individuals, they might really struggle if they caught COVID-19. And in terms of co-infection, overall, doctors are saying that it's pretty rare. The rates are pretty rare, which is good news. But at the same time, it is possible. Kern Medical has seen some cases. And what co-infection looks like is a developing story. earlier this week, I spoke to Dr. Arash Hideri at Kern Medical's Valley Fever Institute, and they had been seeing a handful of blood tests where Valley Fever is reactivating or coming back in patients when they get sick with COVID-19, which is kind of alarming, pretty alarming. And so here's how Dr. Hideri explains it.
We were in the clinic, and me and my colleague, Dr. Kuram, I just jumped to her room, and I said, have you noticed a bump in the Valley Fever test when you get COVID? And she goes, oh, yeah, I've noticed two today, and I had three the other day. So it was like five cases between me and her. So to me, it's not a coincidence. Is this clinically meaningful or not? At this time, I don't know, but we're going to investigate that.
So Dr. Hideri, he did say that the patient's outcomes were good. The Valley Fever actually stabilized pretty quickly as COVID-19 symptoms started to subside. So maybe there's something going on in the immune system there, but they're still trying to figure all that out.
Wow. Well, so before the pandemic, you know, diagnosing Valley Fever was challenging enough. You know, it is commonly misdiagnosed, sometimes as pneumonia, even lung cancer. How has the pandemic, where many symptoms of COVID are similar to Valley Fever, at least in the beginning, how has the pandemic affected how doctors are actually looking for Valley Fever?
Yeah, it's kind of been a little bit of a diagnosis dilemma. As you mentioned, a lot of the symptoms initially can have a lot of overlap. So COVID-19 and Valley Fever both have the cough and shortness of breath, the chills. So in places like Kern County, for a while, the doctors there had been describing the combo of the flu, the Valley Fever, and COVID-19 as this triple threat that they were dealing with in terms of diagnosing. So this is how Rasha Curran at Kern Medical's Valley Fever Institute, she explains it a little bit further about the challenges that they're going through in terms of diagnosing.
You know, for most people everywhere else, they've been dealing with differentiating whether respiratory illness is influenza versus COVID. But for us here, it's three things instead of two. And despite being very different in terms of Valley Fever being a fungal infection, influenza and SARS-CoV-2 infection are viruses, they do present very similarly and strikingly similar presentations. Someone coming in before you do the test, they could be sometimes impossible to tell apart at the beginning. So it really is a challenge.
But they have been able to find some distinguishable signs between the two. So the loss of taste and smell and that sore throat often point towards COVID, for instance. And there are, you know, with Valley Fever, you sometimes get rashes and lesions. To our knowledge, you don't get that with COVID-19. Most importantly, COVID-19 is transmissible between person to person. Valley Fever is not. You can only get it by breathing in this fungus that's, you know, kicked up from the soil into the air, like, you know, during a dust storm or something like that, or construction work. But really the definitive thing is doing the tests. So, you know, Dr. Hideri, Dr. Curran, they're both saying in these communities in, you know, the Valley and in other Southwest communities, you need to test for these diseases, because it definitely is still a possibility.
And let's talk about the COVID-19 vaccine a little bit. So as you said earlier, it doesn't appear that most people who have had Valley Fever are more susceptible to COVID. So what does that mean for, you know, here in California, as the state is about to open up vaccine eligibility next week for those who are medically vulnerable under age 65, what does that mean for those who have had severe Valley Fever or who might still have severe Valley Fever?
Yeah. So looking at that list, which is, you know, I, as you mentioned, I think it's rolling out soon. It doesn't sound like Valley Fever is explicitly stated on that list. However, it sounds like it's, you know, up to the doctor's discretion whether or not you are at some level of vulnerability or higher risk of getting COVID or having complications. So there is that. But Dr. Hideri did tell me he has absolutely zero concerns for Valley Fever patients to receive the vaccine. There isn't any known additional risks of receiving the vaccine if you have Valley Fever. And the CDC has also said that COVID-19 vaccines can be given to people with underlying pre-existing medical conditions. So to our knowledge, to the experts' knowledge, there is no safety concerns there.
And then, you know, just before the pandemic, it really felt like momentum was building in the field of Valley Fever research after decades of being underfunded. Has COVID-19, has this pandemic affected how that research is going?
Yeah, and I know that you've done a lot of great work in reporting on that research that's been going on. And yeah, unfortunately, it has slowed down quite a bit in light of the pandemic. And universities and researchers, they've had very limited to no access to facilities during the shutdown. Right before the pandemic, I heard from Katrina Hoyer at UC Merced, who studies Valley Fever. She had received funding for a Valley Fever study on T cells, but then she had to put pause when everything started to shut down. And so this is what she told me back in January about her experience.
I basically just wrote my progress report to the NIH and had to explain why we have no data for them over a year. I say this for Valley Fever, but this is true for pretty much everything that's not COVID related. We are not making progress on other diseases right now. And I'm concerned about what that's going to do for the other health problems that we have to deal with when we get through COVID.
Professor Hoyer also mentioned a lot of her collaborators who are clinicians are pulmonologists, which means they've been pulled away to assist with the demands of COVID-19. That's also slowed down a lot of the research questions she's wanted to investigate in relation to Valley Fever and the commingling with COVID and Valley Fever. She's still exploring other aspects of Valley Fever in the meantime. She hasn't like completely stopped everything. So anything that requires not too much lab time or that she could do from home. So she's right now, for instance, she's working with a student on some existing data on wildfire smoke and Valley Fever. So I'm really interested to hear what kind of findings she comes out of with that.
Again, that was Lauren Young, a science reporter and digital producer for Science Friday. One other interesting parallel she told me about between these two diseases, even though Valley Fever isn't contagious from person to person, masks are one of the best ways to prevent Valley Fever infections because they reduce the risk of inhaling the spores that cause the disease.
That is so interesting. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The controversial sale of Fresno's Tower Theater to Adventure Church has drawn months of protest and legal battles. As the close of escrow remains in limbo, local arts reporter Donald Monroe found himself asking why the church is so determined to purchase the landmark. I spoke to Monroe about his recent column on the controversy and got his recommendations for this year's virtual Rogue Festival, which wraps up on Sunday. In the commentary that you wrote about the potential sale of the Tower Theater for MonroeReview.com, you speculate about the motives that are involved for each of the parties. Let's go ahead and start with Adventure Church. From your perspective, what is in it for them?
Well, I have to begin by saying that it really is speculation. I can not get into the minds of the people involved, nor do I have any really insider information. But I have spent some time trying to figure out why the church would want to buy the tower. There seem to be so many reasons not to buy the tower. Number one would be that it's a historic landmark. You're very limited in terms of what you can do to change either the outside or the inside. You have all the expenses that are related to the upkeep of a historic landmark. It does not seem like it is configured in its present condition to be a very good interior of a church. I think there would be some challenges there. It's really expensive.
Right.
It's like, I don't know how a church on its own would be able to afford something that expensive. And then there is the depth of the opposition in the neighborhood. It's not really good karma, I think, for a church to move in somewhere where it is so definitely not wanted. So that's what got me to thinking about what were the motivations.
But given all of those reasons not to buy it, why do you think they are so invested in this particular property?
I think, and I speculate in my piece about this, I think there are two major motivations. One is financial, or I think we can look at this situation from these two motivations. One is financial and one is religious. I think that there's a very strong religious component here. I think that this is part of the culture war mentality that we have in this country. And I think that there is a certain appeal to the idea of moving in to the city's most liberal, gay-friendly district and sort of establishing a huge and giant presence there.
Okay, so well, let's shift gears and talk about the theater's owner, Lawrence Abbott. Where do you think his head is at in this transaction? Is it as simple as he's just looking to sell to the highest bidder, or is religion or the culture wars also playing a role, do you think, maybe from that perspective?
I do not think that he is just interested in the price. I think that there's something more. I think that the fact that this church is very conservative meshes with his political standpoint. I think we saw a very concrete reflection of that when, after Rush Limbaugh's passing, he posted that message on the marquee of the Tower Theater mourning his death. I think that most reasonable people would know that an act like that would create a lot of controversy in the community.
So you have been covering arts in the Central Valley for quite some time, and I could think of no other person who could better articulate how significant the Tower Theater is to the arts scene in Fresno.
Like I tell people, when you go to the homepage of the Fresno Convention and Visitors Bureau, what do you see? Or how do we talk about our city? People will talk about the Tower District. We point to the Tower District as a point of pride. We say, look, we're like other medium-sized cities. We have a vibrant arts and entertainment district. And so the Tower Theater itself, of course, is a large, beautiful facility that attracts some very prominent touring entertainers and has some local users that are quite prolific. But it also serves as a symbol of the fact that, yeah, this city has a progressive district. It has a good nightlife. It does have arts. It does have entertainment. Don't laugh at us. Fresno does have culture.
Well, and one of the big events of the year is actually taking place right now, the Rogue Fest. I would be remiss in talking to you without getting your feedback on this year's festival, which is, of course, all virtual. Before I get your picks for this final upcoming weekend, tell us about the festival in general. What's it been like this year? And what's jumped out at you as a real highlight?
Well, the Rogue made the decision to soldier on, even though they knew that everything would have to be virtual. And it is a much scaled down version of what the festival usually looks like. In person, in a regular year, you have up to 8 venues at the same time offering fringe festival acts. You have hundreds of people kind of milling around the Tower District, kind of enjoying that artistic vibe. It's really Fresno's answer to, say, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's a time that people gather together. So, of course, we can't do any of that. It's all on Zoom. There are only about half as many acts and performers that are participating in this year's festival. Some of those acts are just pre-recorded. So, say somebody in Texas, for example, puts together a 2-person show and records that, and then they play that for their road performance. Other acts are actually live. And it's been interesting seeing how different acts kind of adapt to this new platform. Attendance is way down. And I'm just estimating that from the shows that I attended last week, where you would see, you know, sell out crowds for the popular titles, and maybe 50, 75 people, 100 people at some of the bigger venues. some of the shows I attended only had 8 people in the audience. So I know that their attendance figures are going to be way down, and I think they're expecting that. But there still is this element of creativity, of, you know, trying to use the format in interesting and creative ways.
So there is one more weekend of performances. What are your picks?
One of my favorite shows that I saw last weekend was a show called, and I'll have to give you the characters, it's hashtag TXT on the internet. So it's text on the internet. And it's a show in which this performance artist who lives in Washington, D.C. sits there in his apartment. And you as an audience member use the chat function on Zoom to make him say things. In other words, you provide the dialogue. And
that sounds dangerous.
It is. And they even tell you beforehand, we have no idea where this is going to go. We don't know what it's, you know, even rated. And the performance I saw, inexplicably, 2 of the audience members were from Milan, Italy. And I have no idea why they were there. They did not seem to know the performer. They did not seem to know anybody else. And so they made him speak in Italian quite often through the show. And they made him say things in Italian that would not be repeatable on this public radio station. It was hilarious.
That sounds like a heck of a show.
And what I like about it is that it uses the Zoom platform as part of the experience. The other thing I like about it is because it kind of makes the audience feel off kilter, especially at the beginning. There are no real directions. Like, you just start to figure out what's going on. He doesn't say anything to you that isn't texted to him. And then once you figure it out, I almost had a sense of duty, I guess, because I'm a writer, and I felt like, oh, I've got to keep him talking because the other people weren't texting as much. So I ended up just writing and writing and writing. It was a trip. I really enjoyed it.
That sounds like fun.
It was fun. Yeah.
Donald Monroe, again, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.